The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Thank you, Bill. It's a good thing I do have at least one allusion to film in my talk here this morning. And I suppose you should be a little bit worried that a computer specialist is speaking on metaphor. I am, in another life, an engineer. What can an engineer say about metaphor? I don't know. This black book, by the way, is a printout of the Gospel of John. It's my security blanket in case I need it. It is my Bible. I just reformat the text so that I can read it more readily. The title for my talk this morning has given me a few fits, actually. It keeps changing, at least is my understanding of it. Until last night, I thought it was Metaphor and Truth, a Bible meditation. Then I read the schedule, and it says, a Bible meditation, Metaphor and Truth. And then Bill says this morning, it's a talk on metaphor. So there's a history here. It was the title assigned to me, not something I came up with. So perhaps you hear me being a little defensive here. But I did take the job. I guess what's troubling me is it's just not a very exciting title. It hardly seems worthy of the subject at hand. Wouldn't it have been better to have something more provocative, something more mysterious, something that actually employed metaphor, something clever? But I'm just too subservient, or perhaps I lacked creativity. Or perhaps the real truth is I was simply embarrassed from the fiasco almost a year ago of trying to come up for a title with my inaugural address as professor of Old Testament. That address focused on a series of rhetorical questions at the end of Deuteronomy 4. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. Where Moses began the climax of his initial speech in Deuteronomy by asking, has anything so great as this ever happened? Well, I use this quote as the title for my lecture. All right, enough said. I never dreamed that others would understand it, but my mother-in-law said to me, what does this mean? For whatever psychological reason, I now take the titles given to me. Two things concern me concerning the title. First, the issue of Bible meditation. Which I had thought was the subtitle. When I took the job for this morning, I thought I was agreeing to a more general task, a more general talk on the problem of metaphor and truth. Yeah, in my boldness or hubris, I thought I could handle that. Then I read the fine print, Bible meditation. The Bible has lots to say about truth, and it seems to use metaphor a great deal. But what does the Bible actually have to say about metaphor? And about metaphor and truth. I was a little bit at a loss how to proceed. In fact, I was ready to say, I think I need to do something else. But in the providence of God, the very next day, before I could tell Bill I had changed my mind, something happened in my devotions that convinced me to stay with the topic. And I'll make that clear later. For now, let me simply say in advance that our text for the Bible meditation this morning will be the entire gospel of John. The reasons will become more obvious as I go along. Now, the main part of the title, Metaphor and Truth. Those of you who were here last night, if you're like me, your hearts were stirred as we heard and saw visual, verbal, and musical images, metaphors. Mourning turned to dancing. I'm in darkness waiting for the light to shine. I hear the words sounding in the cathedrals of my heart. Perhaps, like me, you were challenged to see Jesus feelingly, to let the settled things become strange and facts become wonders. But metaphor and truth, that about which I'm going to be speaking now for the rest of the morning, or the rest of my time this morning, have not always been best friends. But I suppose if Dr. Logan can talk about Lear and Jonathan Edwards in the same breath, then I should be able to talk about metaphor and truth. I don't know if Sam is here this morning, but my apologies to him. There he is. But I couldn't resist. Seriously, though, from ancient Greek philosophers to present-day literary theorists, people have questioned whether metaphor can indeed tell the truth. Metaphor and truth have hardly been regarded as soup and sandwich combination. While this is meant to be a Bible meditation, I would like to lay out a few of the objections put forth against metaphor and use these objections as our springboard into the Bible, in particular the Gospel of John. Just a parenthetical comment here. I recognize that figures of speech is the broader of category. Metaphor is the more narrow category. Indeed, perhaps the queen of the figures of speech. But there is also a sense in which metaphor and figure are used interchangeably, and you will hear me doing that some today, and also using the word image. So understand I'm using these words in a sort of synonymous fashion. Okay. As I suggested, there have been some problems between metaphor and truth. Historically, as I have indicated, they haven't been happy bedfellows. In spite of generations of high school English teachers teaching us all about figures of speech, how to understand them, how to use simile, distinguish it from personification, we are still uneasy and even a little dubious on a gut level that metaphor can really be used to communicate the truth. And this is true of our culture at large, as well as Christianity, more narrowly speaking. As early as the Greek period, we hear Aristotle say about the role of metaphor and image in poetry that if it is in our interest to be cheated, it is poetry's duty to cheat us. That's in his treatise on poetry. Need I say that Aristotle's personification of poetry as a cheater suggests that there's something underhanded about poetry's use of metaphor? So what are some of the problems with metaphor? Let me just give you some quick bullets here. I'm not going to elaborate at great length. Metaphor is a literal lie. It functions on the basis of expressing something else, something in terms of something it really isn't. For example, I could say, my love is a rose, but you all know my wife is a woman and not a flower. How can such a trick of language tell the truth? Secondly, metaphor leaves too much to the imagination. The human being is invited to have, the audience is invited to have too much control. Thirdly, metaphor is the product of chance associations by human interpreters. Fourthly, metaphor is said to appeal to treacherous human emotions. The real danger of the trope, according to Perry Miller, commenting on the Puritan understanding of tropes or metaphors, images, is the associations it happens to excite in the impressionable but treacherous senses of men. Another knock against metaphor is that it's not easily reduced to propositions. And this can be a challenge as we are interested in the Bible for doctrinal formulation. Don't misunderstand me here. I am not criticizing or denigrating doctrinal formalization, but it does create challenges. Metaphor is not easily, thank God, reduced to proposition. Sixthly, metaphor is often viewed merely as a rhetorical embellishment. Rhetoricians past and present really haven't helped either. While they perhaps defend their use of metaphor, they often still express it in terms of embellishment, something almost ornamental that merely wiggled the emotions. M.H. Abrams, a modern-day literary scholar, says that truth constitutes the basic subject matter, but myth and other literary impossibilities, understand metaphor here, are necessary to embellish the truth and rescue it from language. Finally, metaphors have been much abused. Samuel Parker, I believe a British Puritan of the 17th century, some historian may help me here, expressed his concern about the impact of metaphor on then-current ecclesiastical affairs by exclaiming that, had we but an act of Parliament to abridge preachers the use of fulsome and luscious metaphors, it might be perhaps an effectual cure of all our present distempers. Unless we think it's just in the church, David Hume, the secular philosopher of more or less the same period, when encountering fanciful imagery, remarks that the mind is displeased to find a picture which bears no resemblance to any original. And lest we think that the abuse of metaphor has gone the way of the 17th century, let me illustrate with a story from our own period. Wayne Booth, the author of The Company We Keep, relates the following story about a lawyer friend of his. His friend had been hired to defend a large southern utility against a smaller southern utility. At first, everything seemed to be going very well for his friend. The law seemed to be on his side. He felt that he had presented his case quite well. And he had just had that sense that comes from experience in the courtroom that he was going to come out a winner. But then the lawyer for the small utility made his closing argument before the jury. So now we see what it is. They got us right where they want us. They're just holding us up with their hand, their good sharp fish knife in the other, and they're saying, you just hold still, you little catfish. We're going to just gut you. That moment, the lawyer of the large utility predicted, accurately as it turned out, that he had lost the case. He had fallen into the hands of a genius with metaphor. So are we really surprised that in our culture, with its modernist legacy of positivism and a belief in precise, verifiable scientific expression, that metaphor has been denied a place at the table of reliable human discourse and communication? But you should all be saying, in this context, hang on, wait a minute, hold on. Biblical authors use metaphor all the time. In fact, Jesus himself did. So metaphor must be all right. Yes. The Gospel of John, our text for this morning, begins with the words, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Apostle John, noted for his simplicity, perhaps even on occasion ungrammaticality of Greek style, has left us a remarkable picture of Jesus. This straightforward, simple communicator gives us perhaps one of the most powerful metaphors in all of biblical literature. In the beginning was the Word. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. In just a few images, he connected the creation story to the story of Jesus. Indeed, the story begun in creation has reached its climax. The one to crush the serpent's head had come, lived, died, and been raised from the dead. The word spoken in the garden was the word spoken in the person of Jesus in John's day. God speaking through his Son in his simple images. John says it better than my many words, unpacking it here today, could ever hope to do. A metaphor used to speak profound truth, unpacked by believers for 2,000 years. Perhaps still our understanding is not exhausted. John not only began with metaphor, but he used them throughout his gospel. Before we turn our attention for a closer look at metaphor in the Gospel of John, let me say a word or two about the genre and overall focus of the message of the Gospel of John. I do this because we can't simply talk about the details of the text without considering how they fit together in the larger whole, lest we understand a reading strategy for the gospel. And to understand this larger whole, this reading strategy, we must first consider the genre of the gospel. What is it? In a word, it's testament. Think about it. Again and again, John spoke of someone testifying to something about Jesus. John the Baptist came to testify to the light. He was not the light, but he came as a witness to the light. He proclaimed that Jesus surpassed him, and he testified that Jesus was the Son of God, and his disciples, that is, John, believed him. The woman at the well testified that Jesus was the Messiah, and her neighbors believed him. The gospel closes, speaking of John, saying, "This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true." And John used the voice of many other witnesses, including God the Father, Moses, and even the Old Testament scriptures. Everyone and everything were called into service to testify concerning Jesus. The point of testimony is to convince and persuade. John's testimony was aimed at convincing his audience the answer to one question: who was Jesus? It's this question that everyone about whom John writes is asking in one way or another. Who was this man? By what authority did he act? How did he do such things? Indeed, a virtual Greek chorus began to emerge as John reported people whispering about Jesus in the background of the unfolding story. "He's a good man." "No, he deceives." "Surely he's the prophet, the Christ." "No, how can the Christ come from Galilee?" "The man does not keep the Sabbath." "But how can a sinner do such miracles?" And the chorus goes on and on, punctuating John's testimony. The key to success of testimony is having sufficient witnesses, more than one. Jesus says so himself in the Gospel of John. And that these witnesses are clear and truthful. In John's testimony, declaring the identity of Jesus through the speeches of so many witnesses, all these witnesses freely and repeatedly use and employ metaphors. For example, in Jesus' own teaching, to the Pharisees, he tells them that he will tear down this temple and rebuild it in 3 days. To Nicodemus, he says, "You must be born again." To the woman at the well, "I will give you water so that you will never have to thirst again." To the Jews, he says, "I am the bread of life, come down from heaven." To the people at the feast, he says, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." Again, to the Pharisees, he says, "Sheep will not follow a stranger because they do not recognize his voice." And to a crowd, he says, "When I am lifted up, I will draw all mankind to me." His self-identification throughout the gospel are in such metaphors and images as, "I am the light of the world. I am the bread of life come down from heaven. I am the true vine. I am the good shepherd." And the testimony of others, John the Baptist, "Behold, the Lamb of God." John the Apostle, as we've already said, "The Word, the light of life." But a problem emerges as you read the gospel more closely. If we go back and reread each of these metaphors, these pictures, in their context, something perhaps a little troubling begins to emerge. People weren't understanding what Jesus was talking about when he spoke to them in figures of speech. And this is all the more peculiar when we recall that testimony is meant to be clear. To the Pharisees, when he said, "Tear down this temple, I will rebuild it in 3 days," the Pharisees didn't get it. They said, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and now you're saying that you're going to rebuild it in 3 days?" When he told Nicodemus he needed to be born again, Nicodemus scratched his head and says, "How can I enter into my mother's womb?" And Jesus rebuked him for being a teacher of the law and not understanding these things. In fact, he calls them earthly things. To the woman at the well, when he told her that he would give her water, that she would never need to thirst again, the woman asks for a drink of water. To the Jews, when he says, "I am the bread of life, come down from heaven," the Jews begin to grumble. They knew where he came from. How could this be one who came down from heaven? How could this be the bread of life? To the people at the feast, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." John provided the editorial notes to say that Jesus was speaking of the Spirit who had not yet been given, suggesting that the people what Jesus was saying. When Jesus told the Pharisees that sheep will not follow a stranger because they did not recognize his voice, John again provided an editorial note to say they didn't understand the figure of speech explicitly in the text that he was using. When he tells the crowd that he must be lifted up and draw all mankind to him, John once again says, in an aside, that he said this to show the kind of death he would die. And implicit, once more, the people didn't understand at the time. In each case, it almost seems that the audience is stumbling over the literal interpretation of what Jesus intended as a figure. But it's not only those outside his immediate circle. The disciples themselves don't get it. Look at the upper room discourse. Look at their final questions to Jesus before he is arrested and taken away. Lord, where are you going? Lord, we don't know the way. Show us the Father. Why do you show us yourself to us and not to the world? And then they began to talk among themselves at the very end. What did he mean when he kept saying, in a little while you will see me no longer? These difficulties in understanding Jesus reach such proportions that the Jews in exasperation will finally say in John chapter 10, verse 24, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. So the Jews and the Pharisees didn't get it. The crowds didn't get it. Nicodemus struggled. So did the woman at the well. Even the disciples had lots of questions to the very end. And a testimony that's meant to persuade and to be clear. John, by way of using the testimony of the Samaritan woman, tells his audience that when the Messiah comes, he will explain everything to us. But something seems to have gone terribly wrong here. We must ask the question, why wasn't anyone getting it? Was there something wrong with Jesus' words? With his explanations? Were his metaphors simply just too difficult? To answer this dilemma, let me digress a moment and finish the story I mentioned earlier about how the Gospel of John came to be my text for this morning. Perhaps seems obvious it's laced with metaphor, but there's something more in the providence of God here. As I told you, when I took this speaking assignment, I thought I was going to be talking about truth metaphor in a sort of more general way. But then, as I told you, I read the fine print where it said Bible meditation. And immediately I began to wonder, what does the Bible say about metaphor? How does it uses metaphor, but what does it say about metaphor explicitly? Nothing that I could think of at that moment. Well, the very next morning, after I told Bill I would speak in this conference on metaphor and truth, I was having my devotions in John chapter 16 and providentially read the following passage. Chapter 16, verse 25. Though, Jesus speaking here, though I have been speaking figuratively, a time is coming when I will no longer use this kind of language, but will tell you plainly about my Father. I sat up wide awake. Jesus was answering the disciples in their confusion over what he had meant when he had told them, in a little while you will see me no more, and then after a while you will see me. And he was explicitly talking about figures of speech. Metaphor. Here was the answer to my concern about Bible meditation and metaphor. I could go ahead with it. He was speaking about metaphor. But he created another problem for me. You can guess what that problem was. He had just thrown his weight behind the superiority of plain speech over against metaphor. Deconstructed my whole talk. What else could I conclude from the context, the disciples' lack of understanding, his saying that plain speech was to follow what up until now had been figurative language? Suddenly, everything I thought about metaphor was just turned upside down on its head. Again, I was ready to change my topic. But maybe I hadn't got it right. So I began to read the Gospel of John over and over again. But my understanding grew cloudier. After this speech in John 16, which was the finale to the Upper Room Discourse, Jesus prayed to his Father and then was arrested. When does this plain speech come? Well, he was brought before the high priest and Pilate. Plain speech there. To the high priest, Jesus said that he had spoken openly to the world, that he said nothing in secret. Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. And that suddenly sounded very ironic in my ears. We've just read the testimony that John and all these witnesses he cited, almost no one seemed to understand or get it. Before Pilate, Jesus tells or says to him that his kingdom was not of this world, that his kingdom was from another place. It sounds a little figurative. When he was raised from the dead, John remarked off the storyline again that the first disciples who had seen the empty tomb still didn't understand that Jesus needed to be raised from the dead. So there's still a problem with understanding. Perhaps this isn't metaphor here, but still a struggle understanding. I was running out of chapters quickly. Where was I going to find this plain speech? Well, I came to Jesus' last conversation in the gospel, conversation with Peter. Three times, what does he say to Peter? We know this well, I think. Feed my sheep. Care for my sheep. And then he gives him this figurative picture of what the future holds for him as a witness to the risen Christ. Metaphor, again. And then the gospel ended. I never found the plain speech that Jesus had promised. And then something else struck me. Remember how the Gospel of John begins? With a metaphor. In the beginning was the Word. So what, you ask? Jesus didn't say anything about metaphor until the end of the Gospel, right? Well, that's a misunderstanding, I think, a little bit about how texts are written. Let me address this in another way. I want to give a little rhetorical quiz to us. That means, rhetorical quiz means that I'm not going to let you give the answer, but I want you to think about it in your mind. Here's the question. Here's my film connection. What does the Gospel of John have in common with the following films? Chariots of Fire, The Name of the Rose, Titanic, Saving Private Ryan, and more recently, The Green Mile. Well, they're not all love stories. That doesn't work. Heroism, well, who's the hero in The Name of the Rose? Christ figures, not in everyone. Perhaps they all use metaphor, and that would almost undoubtedly be true. But I think there's something more obvious. Think about how each film tells its story. At the beginning of each of the movies, an elderly person in the present day recalls events from their youth, a lifetime in the past. Each movie then comes full circle after the story is told, and concludes by returning to the words of this elderly storyteller in the present day. It's a sort of narrative bookends, giving symmetry to the story and also providing a voice to give a final interpretation to the tale. While it may not be explicit in the text or immediately obvious, the Gospel of John is an ancient example employing the same technique. Most scholars are agreed that the Gospel was penned late in John's life, at a very old age, perhaps as much as half a century after the events he narrates. His original audience would certainly have been aware that it was an aged John speaking at the beginning and at the end, and would have heard an elderly voice introducing the gospel with the words, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." He was with God at the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that light was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood. The point here is this. These first words in John's gospel are better thought of as his last words. The fruit of a lifetime of reflecting on the life and ministry of Jesus, his words, their meaning, to distilled from a lifetime of meditating and teaching about the events he had witnessed. These opening words come long after the events about which he narrates. They introduce the events after the fact, a kind of aperture of all that will follow. With these words, John gives us his interpretation of what Jesus' life, death, and resurrection meant for the first church. And what followed was the story of Jesus. As I said, it was his testimony. But the significant detail to notice is that all these years later, John still began with a metaphor. John, who certainly heard Jesus say that he would no longer use figurative language, but would use plain speech. Didn't John get it either? Why did he, who makes such a point of the challenges that people had in understanding the metaphors of his gospel, who heard Jesus explicitly say that he would no longer speak figuratively, why did he lapse back into that metaphor? Didn't he understand? Once more, I was sent back to reread the gospel again and again. These issues in mind. And slowly, the real problem began to emerge. Men loved darkness rather than the light. They had no room for my word in their heart, said Jesus. They loved the praises of men more than the praise of God. They were blind, and their hearts were hard. John chapter 12. In chapter 8, verse 43, Jesus puts it most pointedly. Why is my language unclear to you? It's because you belong to the Father, your father, the devil, who is the father of lies. He goes on to say, you don't recognize me as the Christ because you don't know my voice, because you don't belong to God. The real problem, it seems then, perhaps, was the people, not the speech. Their hearts were hard. They didn't hear because they loved darkness rather than light. It wasn't just that they had a literalist bent. It was the fallenness and sinfulness of man that had blinded them. They are without excuse. What is the solution to this dilemma of understanding the metaphors? What does the gospel provide as an answer? Jesus did speak plainly, and he spoke with his final actions, with his death and his resurrection. Everything was changed by those events. Hard hearts became new hearts of flesh for those who believed after he was raised from the dead. The door was open for Jesus to give the promised Spirit, who would teach them what Christ's words, including his figures of speech, had meant. In chapter 8, verse 28, after John noted that people did not understand that Jesus had been telling them about the Father, John recounted these words of Jesus. When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am the one I claim to be, and that I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me. When he is lifted up, crucified, and then lifted up again, raised from the dead, then they will know. And John added other such notes, revealing the post-resurrection perspective for understanding. When the Pharisees had failed to understand that Jesus spoke of rebuilding the temple in 3 days, John noted that when he was raised from the dead, the disciples finally understood and believed. Also, John implied in his offline remarks about the living waters that they understood that these living waters were the Spirit after Jesus had been glorified and the Spirit given. And there are many examples in the gospel of such language, of how they understood after the resurrection and the giving of the Spirit. They understood because they received new hearts. They understood because the climax of the story had come, and they had the Spirit to teach them what everything had meant. And they went back and re-listened to the words of Jesus, his figurative language, the metaphors. And they saw them with new hearts in light of the resurrection. And everything became new and different. There was never a problem with metaphor. Indeed, John stirred the hearts of his audience with his metaphorical opening to the gospel. Metaphor was most serviceable for John in telling the truth. The real culprit was the sinful human heart. Jesus has solved the problem of the hard, sinful heart with his death and his resurrection. Those who believe could now go back, reread the story with new hearts, filled with the spirit of truth, and understand in light of the climax of the events of Jesus' death and resurrection. It's like the murder mystery. Read along, and then you come to the climax, the denouement. You find out who done it. And everything in the story takes on new significance. So too here. When the Jews had asked Jesus in chapter 10 why he kept them in suspense, why he didn't tell them plainly if he was the Christ, Jesus had given them an answer. I have told you, but you did not believe. The miracles I do Father's names. What Jesus does is his speech, his plain speech, as are his words. His death and resurrection have spoken for him. This was and remains the plain speech about which Jesus spoke. He was and is the Word. We can say, in the light of the end of the story, that the figures of speech are in some sense transformed. Herod's temple that took 46 years to build moves off stage. The temple that is Jesus' body advances front stage. Jesus' body became the reality of which the temple of stone had become now but a shadow. The second hearing of the figures, in light of the climax of the story, with the power of the resurrection at work in their lives, and the spirit in new hearts, changes everything. The Word made flesh has come to dwell among us, so that even the dead will hear and be rescued from the darkness. As we heard last night, we long to break free from the darkness into the light, to move from confusion to understanding, to have our mourning turn to dancing. Jesus has spoken plainly to make this possible. He has spoken with his death and resurrection. Let us be witnesses to the Word made flesh. Let us not be afraid to tell the truth with metaphor. Metaphor pierces the heart in a way the proposition seldom can. Perhaps the way to the mind is through the heart. Our next speaker, Larry Wywood, has said that metaphor is the outward substance of a person's inner being, and that metaphor makes the world of the Word flesh. Let's make the world of the Word flesh. Tune your heart and mind to the Spirit and listen to both. Metaphor is not a luxury. It's essential.